As you know, we are looking at the end times. I might come over this way a little bit. If you can't see this from the back, it doesn't really matter. It's probably the worst timeline you'll ever see. And before we do that, there was a Bible study group, and they were talking about the end times. And the Bible study leader said, you know, it's inevitable that one day we are going to die. And knowing that inevitability, we should be ready and we should be prepared and we should be living accordingly, shouldn't we? And everyone nodded in assent, yes, we should. So the Bible study leader posed this scenario. He said, well, what if you knew that you only had 4 weeks to live? How would that affect the way that you lived? Well, one person raised their hand and said, I would go and preach the gospel to everyone I know that hasn't accepted Jesus. And everyone nodded and said, yes, that would be very good. There's a lady who put her hand up and said, I would live diligently and with conviction, serving my family and my church. And everyone nodded their assent and said, yes, that makes sense. Then there was a random guy at the back. He raised his hand. He said, I'd go and stay with my mother-in-law for 4 weeks. And everyone looked really puzzled. Couldn't work out why he would say that. Anyway, the study leader asked him, why did you say that you would go and live with your mother-in-law? He said, because it'd be the longest 4 weeks of my life. Now, anyway, I'm not hiding. There's a shout out to all the mother-in-laws out there, including my own. You know, so I was very brave and I told that joke while she wasn't here. So far, we've been looking at, we've looked at a number of things. We've looked at, first of all, how is Jesus coming back? He's coming back in power and in glory. We've looked at why is Jesus coming back? Spent a whole week looking at 4 or 5 reasons why we should understand that Jesus is coming back. And then we've been also looking at how then we should live in the light of all of this. Well, this morning we have come to the place that we must come to. Any discussion on the end times must include at the very least, a summary of the book of Revelation. And so that's where we are this morning. So simply what I want to do is give you an outline that then you can use as a way of studying Revelation for yourself. Let me just say a few things by way of introduction. The first is this, that this is not necessarily a very clearly defined timeline, and there's a reason for that. The other thing I want to say is that partway through this message, you will be confused. And there's a reason for that. Okay? No, I'm serious. There's a reason why you'll be confused, and I'll explain to you why it is that you are somewhat confused. The third thing I want to say is this, that you'll notice, and some of you have seen before, you've seen Revelation timelines before. Now, what you won't see here is there is, if this was a discussion by another theologian, you would see a line here, down here, between the present day and the bulk of Revelation. You would see a line, and that line would demark the rapture of the church. So the thought in the minds of some prominent theologians and many Christians is that the next thing that is going to happen is that the church, that's you and I, are going to be raptured out of this world, right? So in 1 Thessalonians 4:17, Paul says, and we who remain will be caught up with the Lord. So that word rapture is the word to be caught up. Physically, it means to be snatched up, but it's an ambiguous word, and it can also mean emotionally caught up. You know, you go to the theatre, and you're in raptures over the dulcet tones of the tenor or the soprano, and that word to be raptured means to be caught up emotionally. And someone might ask you, you know, how was church this morning? Oh, I was rapt. hypothetically speaking, of course. I was rapt, you know, I was caught up in raptures. And so this word rapture, which appears in 1 Thessalonians 4:17, many Christians believe belongs here. So that the very next thing between present day and the development of these signs of the ends of the time, the very next thing to happen is the rapture of the church. Now, if that was the case, and if I believed that, there would be no need to talk about the rest of Revelation, because the next thing that's going to happen is Jesus is going to come back, and we're going to be caught up with him, and what happens after that doesn't really matter. So let me say right off the bat, I don't believe that. I don't believe that the rapture fits here. There's three reasons for that. Reason number one is that there are a number of passages that indicate, and one of them is Matthew 24, when Jesus said, if those days were not cut short, even the elect would not survive. And the elect there means the church. Now, I know in other places in the Bible, the elect can mean the Jewish people, the Israeli people, but in that context, it means the church. So Jesus is foreshadowing that the church would live through the time of the great trouble, the great tribulation. The greatest contribution that the book of Revelation makes to end time thinking is it talks about what's literally called the big trouble. Big trouble, not big trouble in little China. Some of you remember that. Big trouble in the world, big trouble globally. So, you know, if there wasn't, if there was a rapture here, we wouldn't need to worry about the big trouble because we won't be here for it. So reason number one is that there are passages that refer to the church being part of the tribulation or the big trouble, including some passages that we'll look at in Revelation. The second thing is this. There are a number of people who believe that it's called the pre-tribulational return of Christ and the church is raptured. And they belong to a schematic or a system of theology called dispensationalism. Don't know whether you've ever heard of dispensationalism, but it basically says that God moves in very clear, precise and distinct dispensations. It's a little bit like when you go to Sizzler and, you know, you go to the dessert bar and there's hundreds and thousands and then there's little M&Ms. And they're all separate, right? And they dispense their goodies separately. And then there's ice cream, chocolate, vanilla. And I'm sorry to introduce this food analogy, but it looks like some of you might need it in your thinking. So, and the thought is that God moves in very, very clear dispensations. And you'll find typically that the Bible is interpreted literally, very literally. Now, let me say I don't agree with that. And for some of you, you might have a Ryrie, Charles Ryrie Study Bible, Scofield, Dakes, that mob, they're the dispensationalists. Now, you know, all due respect to them, I don't agree with it, and for the reasons given. The third reason is this, that the Bible indicates all the way through that God's people will be subject to trial and tribulation and trouble. So it's not a matter of like, it's simply a matter of degree in the big trouble. Okay, so I've got that out of the way, and I'm happy to have a discussion with you afterwards. Those of you who believe that we are raptured here, I'm sorry, but I've just ruptured your rapture theory. You may still believe that, and that's okay. Let me just say this. What I'm going to do this morning is I'm going to give you a warning about the worst case scenario. If I'm wrong, and we are raptured here and we don't live through the tribulation, if I'm wrong, then you can sue me. Because if I'm wrong, we'll all be in the presence of Jesus. And in the days to come, my job will be redundant anyway. Right? You realize that pastors are not going to be required in heaven. I won't be needed as a pastor in heaven. I'm probably going to go onto the road detail polishing the gold. So if I'm wrong, I'll put my hand up and say I was wrong. But if I'm right and I didn't warn you, then what? So I'd rather warn you and suffer the possibility of being wrong than not warn you at all and actually be right. Okay. I know, this is heavy going, I know, isn't it? It's heavy. Kind of feel like you need a coffee, an early morning break or something. So let me just explain the big bulk of Revelation. The bulk is this, that there are three sets of seven troubles. So first of all, there is the seven seals. And in the seven seals you have, and this is just a summary, you can read this. In Revelation 6, you have aggression, bloodshed, famine, disease, earthquakes, persecution, and martyrdom. One group of seven. Then you have an interlude, and we'll come back to the interludes in a minute. Then in Revelation 8, you have the seven trumpets. Scorched earth, polluted sea, contaminated water, reduced sunlight, an insect plague, and a vast array, a vast army coming from the east of 200 million marching towards Jerusalem. You have another interlude, and then you have Revelation 16. And some of you are looking at this and you can see, oh, that's Revelation 10 to 11. How come that's an interlude to Revelation 16? I'll come to that in a moment. In Revelation 16, you have the seven bowls of God's wrath. You have disease. The sea turns to blood. By the way, I don't know whether you know this, but in small part, this has already happened. There's places where large tracts of the ocean, large parts of the ocean have turned to blood, and it's actually red algae. And in some places, it's dumping of illegal waste. In China, I think, in the recent years, large part of the Chinese sea turned, well, not a large part, but a significant part turned red. And it was illegal dumping of waste. You'll have people scorched by the sun, you know, slip, slop, slap. Remember that? And you'll have total darkness. Now, let me say something about these lots of seven. Each successive group of seven is worse than the last or the first. The last four, five, six, and seven are worse than the first two or three. So you have this escalating sense of trouble and tribulation. The seven seals are man-made trouble. The seven trumpets are natural disasters, which you could say are man-made as well. And the seven bowls of God's wrath are God's anger, is an expression of God's anger poured out on this world. And some of you say, well, that doesn't sound like, you know, Jesus meek and mild. Does God get angry? Yes, he does. God does get angry, and you can see glimpses of this in the Gospels where Jesus went to the temple and overthrew the tables in the temple, and the Bible tells us that he intentionally made a whip. It wasn't just impulse, it wasn't just spontaneous. His anger was expressed in the overturning of the tables, and he actually whipped people. Parents, you can cover the ears of your children. You need to give some context to this. Jesus is loving and gracious and merciful, and Jesus is righteous and angry, and we need to hold those two things in tension. The seven bowls of God's wrath. So the question then is, how do they relate together? I hope you've got your Bibles open, if you've got your Bibles with you. How do they relate together? And some people say, do they relate sequentially? Is there one after another? Do they happen simultaneously? And the answer is that there's no easy reconciliation to that. It's hard to work out how they relate. Are they all going to happen together? Is there going to be a successive build-up? What we do know is that for each of these seven sets of trouble, there is a seventh seal, there's a seventh trumpet, there's a seventh bowl of God's wrath, and they all relate, the seventh all relates to one event. So if you study this yourself this afternoon, you know, once you've watched the footy, you can get out Revelation and you can study this for yourself. you'll see that the seventh of each relates to one single event. That we don't know how they relate together. When it happens, we'll find out. The other thing I want to say is this, that you'll find a recurring word in these sets of troubles, and the word is this, woe. Particularly in the final four, five, and six, you'll find the word woe, and when you hear the word woe, it's the word which is opposite to the word blessed. And when you hear the word woe, it's not good. You remember in the Gospels, Jesus is in the region of Galilee and he's walking through and he sees a city, it's called Chorazin, and he says to Chorazin, woe to you, Chorazin. He sees another city, one of them's Capernaum, and then he sees another city, and I forget what that city is, but he pronounces a woe on those three cities. Well, if you go to the region of Galilee today, those three cities, in fact, I think there's four, those four cities are not there anymore. And this is the region of Galilee that used to be a thriving region of some 250,000 people. There's only one city that you can stay in at the region of Galilee, and it's the city of Tiberias, and it's the only city that Jesus did not pronounce a woe over. So when you hear the word woe, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. Okay, let's look at the interludes. And are you confused? Now, what happens is this. The book of Revelation looks forward. It looks back. It looks forward. It looks back. It looks at the current circumstance. It looks forward. It looks back again. So it's almost like John is all over the place sequentially. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is this. That Jesus said, no one knows the time or the day of his return. Not even he knew that. And if God wanted us to know, he would have communicated that quite clearly. If there was to be a timeline as a code written into a portion of Scripture, lengthy or otherwise, then God would have made that clear. But you do not get that clarity in the book of Revelation. It's kind of all over the place. So let's have a look at these interludes because they're quite interesting. Are you with me so far? All right. Somewhere here I had some glasses. The first interlude is in chapter 7. So just turn to that quickly. And if you can't see at the back, which you probably can't, chapter 7 of Revelation, there's two groups of people. So let's just read this quickly together and try and understand what it might be saying. Two groups of people. Reading from verse 1. After this I saw four angels standing, holding back the four winds of the earth to prevent any wind from blowing on the land or on the sea or on any tree. Then I saw another angel coming up from the east having the seal of the living God. And he called out in a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to harm the land and the sea. Do not harm the land or the sea or the trees until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God. And then I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. Tribe of Judah, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, Benjamin. Try saying that underwater with a mouthful of marbles. And so you have this picture, first of all, of the 12 tribes of Israel. This is the first group of people that are referred to in this interlude between the seven seals and the seven trumpets. And so in the tribulation, we will see, those of us who are there, and let's be honest, some of us could be there through this time, we will see the 12 tribes of Israel represented. Now, you might think, so what? Big deal. You may have heard about the lost 10 tribes of Israel. Have you ever heard about the lost 10 tribes of Israel? In other words, Israel currently is populated with people who are from the two southern tribes. And remember, Israel was rent in two and was deported. Currently, Israel is populated with people from the two tribes, the southern tribes, And it's said that the other 10 tribes are lost. Well, how do you lose 10 tribes? I can lose my keys and my glasses, but how can you lose 10 tribes of people? That supposedly they are lost, but I want you to know that they are not lost to God. God knows where those 10 tribes are. And in the tribulation, all 12 tribes will be represented in Israel, in Jerusalem, numbering 12,000 each. It's a limited number. And it's quite clear, I think, from the from this passage that God will protect this number of people through the tribulation. Then you might ask the question, well, what on earth are they doing? And I want to say to you, they are actually evangelizing the world. There's a, I forget his name now. It's either, his surname is either Goldstein or as you would expect. But he is a Messianic Jew. And he was asked the question once, what are the 12 tribes going to do through the tribulation? And he said, of course, we're going to evangelize the world. Look at our nature. Look at our character. We are the best salesmen in the world. And he said, we are going to take people by the throat. We're going to hold them against the wall. And we're going to keep them there until they profess Jesus. Well, I don't know whether that's going to happen. But I, you know, the 12 tribes of Israel will be there in the tribulation, the big trouble. The second group of people, and this is a little bit more concerning. And this is the passage that we read before. And after this, I looked and before me was a great multitude. Who's this multitude? Well, it goes on to say down below, these are those who have come out of the tribulation. That's an unusual expression. How are people coming out of the tribulation? Now, some people think that God is going to rapture people, ones, twos, threes. You know, you see people disappear. You know, boom, gone. Driving, bang, gone. Driver's gone. You know, the passengers. And the thought is that people are going to be raptured out of the world one, two, three times. So I want to say to you that there will be Christians in the tribulation, and the only way that they will come out of the tribulation is that they will be martyred. So when it says that they were coming out of the tribulation, it means that they have been martyred. And in the tribulation, there will be the greatest number of, I believe, there will be the greatest number of martyrs of any time in the church history. There will be people, Christians, who will die for their faith in Jesus. And these are the people who are coming out of the tribulation. Well, went really quiet then. interlude number two. If you go over to Revelation chapter 10 and 11. Particularly verse 11, chapter 11, there's two witnesses. So in the first interlude, you have two groups of people. Second interlude, you have two witnesses. And these two witnesses are prophetic witnesses to the gospel. And it tells us that they are prophesying, they are prophetically witnessing to the gospel in Jerusalem. And then it tells us that they will die. They will be killed. And their bodies will lay on the streets for 3.5 days. And then they'll be raised to life again. What does that remind you of? It reminds you of the resurrection of Jesus. And the other thing that comes to light in this interlude is the length of the tribulation. 42 months, 1260 days, which is 3.5 years. Now, some of you who are astute will notice I haven't introduced the book of Daniel this morning. Because if you are confused now, wait till we try and marry the book of Daniel and Ezekiel and other prophecies with the book of Revelation. And for those of you who would like to do that as kind of a workshop thing, when Nick comes back, he's offering to do that with you. No. I'd be happy to do that. I don't think the sermon context is probably the best time for that. But there are certainly similarities and overlaps. So Revelation tells us that the time of the tribulation is 3.5 years. That's a relatively short time, isn't it? And you have the voice of the martyrs and the Christians in the tribulation crying out, "How long, O Lord, will this go on for? Because it's intense." And the answer is not a very long time, only 3.5 years. And then we have interlude number three. And in interlude number three, there's a number of things to draw out, but let's just have a look at the two beasts. Chapter 13, verse 1. "The dragon stood on the shore of the sea, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on its horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority, and one of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound. But that fatal wound had been healed, and the whole world was filled with wonder and followed the beast. People worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast. They also worshipped the beast. Who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it? The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies." And so it goes on. And then there's another beast. The first beast is the Antichrist. The second beast is the false prophet. And the beast that comes out of the earth is the false prophet. And then if we go over to verse 18, "This calls for wisdom. Let the person who has insight calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. That number is 666. Now, one of the questions was, who is or what is the Antichrist? Now, let me be very general and say, at this point we don't know, right? At this point we don't know. It would seem that in part the Antichrist could be a coalition of nations. It could be, in the description of the 10 and the 7, it could be a coalition of nations. And this is just spitballing now, but, and by the way, interesting development in the European Union. I don't know whether you know or not, but there was some time ago, 50 years ago nearly, when the European Union was first established, there were 6 member countries. And so all the evangelical Christians who are trying to read things into things said, "Ooh, this looks interesting." And so the member nations grew and grew. And when it got to 10, they said, "Ah, that's it. European Union is the Antichrist." But now there's 27 member nations, so kind of hoses down that theory. Surrounding Israel, now remember, these events have a large focus around Israel. So surrounding Israel, you have quite easily, you have 10 antagonistic nations. You have Libya, you have Egypt, you have Saudi Arabia, you have Yemen, you have the AEU, you have Iran, you have Iraq, you have Lebanon, you have Kuwait. It is not too difficult, and I'll come back to this in a moment, it is not too difficult to imagine a coalition of nations around Israel that could perhaps be the fulfillment of this prophecy. But let me say this, and the other thing, and I do want to come back to the European Union in a moment, but let me say this, at this point we do not know. I don't know. I don't know who the Antichrist is. The reality is that there have been many Antichrists. People looked at Hitler and said, "That man is an Antichrist," and biblically speaking, that's true because the Bible speaks about multiple Antichrists. Anyone who murders 6 million people is Antichrist in their nature. Gaddafi, Stalin, Napoleon, any number of dictators in the history of the world you could look at and say, that is the Antichrist. The other reality, of course, is that there was a time when people were postulating the theory that the Roman Catholic Church was the Antichrist. Well, there was a time when the Catholic Church was Antichrist in its nature, when it was selling indulgences to people, which was for the forgiveness of their sin. That's antichrist in its nature. I'll come back to that shortly. So here we have this kind of confused, jumbled picture of looking ahead, looking back, looking at the present, and there is no distinct timeline, except I would say that following the Great Tribulation, there will be the rapture of the church, and following that will be the millennial reign of Christ. Now, there's a few gaps to fill in there, and we'll do that next week. Let me say this. Different ways of interpreting the book of Revelation. There's what's called the preterist view, which says that all of Revelation was fulfilled in the first couple of centuries of the church. Then there's the view that says that there is an overlay over an overlay, like layer upon layer upon layer, you know, like a day in his pastry. And there's overlays of truth which are actually reflected in church history from the day that the church began through to current time. But I want to say to you, I do believe that there is a futurist interpretation of Revelation, but we don't know the sequence of these things. Are they simultaneous? Are they successive? We do know the time, I think, 3.5 years of intense persecution, tribulation, martyrdom. And the world will be a horrible, horrible place. However, having said that, I do see through history the development of some of these things as a foretaste, like the antichrists. One thing I didn't mention, and one of the nations I didn't mention was the nation of Turkey. And the nation of Turkey is an interesting nation for a number of reasons. The current president of Turkey is a man called Recep Erdogan, and he is someone who is viewed by the world at large as a successful model of moderate / secular Islam. But Erdogan is an interesting character. He has already made claims that he is God. Whether he's made those claims himself or whether people have made them about him is a moot point, but there's claims that Erdogan is God. As a person, his personal wealth is $2 billion, and he earns, as a president, $198,000 per annum. I know. There's a few gaps in that theory. Erdogan is in command of the second biggest NATO arms force, you know, under the umbrella of NATO, the second biggest. Now, that doesn't include Russia, of course. My knowledge is Russia's not part of NATO, is it? But he is. And see, what concerns me is this. Extreme Islam, I think in the end days, and talking about the Antichrist, Islam has a huge place in that whole scheme. And what concerns me is this. It's not the extreme Islamic people. It is the lack of comment by the so-called moderates to bring extremists into line. And it never works when Christians try to address Islamic extremists or vice versa. And what concerns me is you have the rise of someone like Recep Erdogan, who is fabulously wealthy, unbelievably powerful, and he's held up on the world stage as a moderate Muslim. In other words, this is how you live as a Muslim state. Now, the other thing in all of that is that Turkey has a long-standing history of hostility with Israel, because it was the Turkish Muslim hordes that first invaded Jerusalem that sparked the Crusades. Now, I'm not saying for a moment that everything that happened from the point of view of the Crusaders was right or godly, but it was that invasion of Jerusalem that started that whole scenario of the Crusades, which is a horrible part of church history. And Israel fell and it was reclaimed, and Jerusalem fell and it was reclaimed. So I don't know. I'm not saying that he's the Antichrist. And if you want to spend a lot of time, you can Google his name, and there's all sorts of evangelical Christian theories about that. But it's something to watch. Something to watch in respect to a coalition of nations that will come against Israel, because John tells us in Revelation that Jerusalem will be trampled under by Gentile feet again. Again. Now, let me get back to the EU, because one of the questions has been, do economic alliances become antichrist? And I think the answer is yes. Now, I don't think it's as simple as saying, well, the antichrist will be a political regime, an economic regime, or a spiritual regime. If you actually look at, and if you mention Islam in this, if you look at Islam, it's everything rolled in together. Don't ever be fooled into thinking that Islam at its base level is all about religion. It's not. Islam is about the conquest of the world. And if you go back to the genesis of Islam, that was Muhammad's aim. Now, it came cloaked in religion, but it was the conquest of the world. So if you then look at the development of economic alliances that have an antichrist element to them, it is rolled in there. And again, if you look at world history, every cycle of war and peace has to do with debt and interest, right? You realise that, don't you? War and peace, the cycles of war and peace simply revolve around debt and interest. And it all happened, it started way back when Seth, and Seth is not his real name, but Seth went to the priests of Baal and said to the priests of Baal, I'm a flourishing farmer, I need a loan for my enterprise. So the priests of Baal said to Seth, okay, well, we will lend you 10 talents. So Seth takes the loan of 10 talents back to his farm, invests. The 10 talents begin to circulate around Seth's community. However, they've charged him 1 talent interest. He owes them 11 talents. So it comes time to pay back the debt. He can't pay it back. He can only pay back 10 talents that are actually in circulation. This is true. If you look into the history of Babylon and the excavations that have been done to uncover the culture, you don't find a lot of coin. You do find a lot of IOUs, the equivalent of IOUs. So Seth comes back to the priests of Baal and says, I can't pay you back. I've only got 10 talents because you only gave me 10 talents to circulate. So what happens? They take him into slavery. They take his wife into slavery. They seize his land. And this happened time and time again. Persia conquered Babylon. Why? Because Persia was in debt to Babylon, because Babylon alone had the currency to lend. And Persia was in debt to Babylon. The only thing it could do was to conquer Babylon. Then suddenly it was wealthy and it could lend to the Greeks. So then Greece was in debt to Persia, right? And the only way that Greece could repay the debt to Persia was to conquer Persia, which happened. And then the Romans conquered the Greeks because they were in debt to the Greeks. And then started an empire that went and went and went for about 1400 years. And the Romans swept all before them. And the Romans moved into Britain and they nearly swept everything, but they got to the border of Scotland. And the Romans looked over the fence into the border of Scotland. And they saw these people wearing skirts with hairy legs protruding out for them. And they said to themselves, if this is what the women look like, we are not going in there. Imagine what the men are like. And so you have this continual cycle of war and peace. War and peace. And what does it revolve around? It revolves around debt and interest. And you still have this played out microcosmically in our economy, where you have governments declaring war on government departments. Medicare. Medicare owes us. We're going to declare war on it and we're going to privatise it. And it's a continual cycle. So that is very much, you know, is the EU or any other economical alliance antichrist? Well, I think it'll be part of it. Not the EU, but an alliance. Let me finish with this. And some of you are thinking, please do. Goodness me. Let me find this momentarily. I'm looking for the passage that says... Sorry, I've lost it. Let me say this. And we'll continue next week. Oh, won't that be good. So far, the instruction in how to live is to be ready and to be vigilant. This morning, the instruction is in how to live. The instruction is to overcome. If there's a theme that runs through Revelation, it's this. In the light of everything that I've told you, which is a worst-case scenario, the thought is this, that we are to overcome. We are to overcome with patient endurance. We are to overcome with loyalty to the gospel. We are to overcome with faithfulness to Jesus. To him who overcomes. And that is the overriding message to Christians who will live through the tribulation. To him who overcomes, I will give the crown of life. So my thought is this. There are dark days coming. If even half of this comes to fruition, there are dark days coming. But to him who overcomes, to him who faithfully endures, to him who perseveres, to him who is true to the gospel of Jesus, to him who does not receive on him or her the mark of the beast. Something we didn't touch on, the mark of the beast, will be a way of trading. Tattooed on the forehead or the palm, that's not a ridiculous notion. Well, you can pay for things with just a flash of your mobile phone, if you've got a smartphone and you're smart enough to operate it. Not me. To him who overcomes in the tribulation, I will give the crown of life. So next week we're going to look at the latter part of this Clayton's timetable that has to do with judgment, heaven, reward, and hell. And that'll take probably a couple of weeks. I'm done. I guess you're done too. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, we kind of stand on the edge of this as somewhat great mystery, but also somewhat veiled truth. Not veiled truth, but truth that's somewhat hidden. And we understand and accept that it will be uncovered and revealed as it needs to be. Help us to live in the way that honours and glorifies you. Help us to persevere. Help us to encourage one another with the thought that these days will be short and the Lord is returning soon. And when you come back to earth, may you find us faithful to the gospel, faithful in proclaiming the gospel. Find us persevering and living in the way that you would want us to, in a way that glorifies you and demonstrates your glory to this world. So for all that's ahead of us, give us grace, endurance, strength, and a peace of heart and mind that passes all understanding. In Jesus' name. Amen.